The thing that you need to know about Billy Collins is that he is a very successful poet. And the two words successful and poet do not sit comfortably together. This is a contradiction in terms. By which I mean that he earns his living writing poetry from royalties of collections and going around and reading his poems in performance. And though he has enjoyed the success that other poets feel is due to them, he is a man without enemies. I have never, ever heard anybody say anything mean about Billy Collins in the world of serious poetry, which is a world that is rife with petty jealousy and bitter denunciations and so forth. The poets of the early 20th century, the serious poets, did not welcome light verse into their world. Robert Frost, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Mae Swenson, Marianne Moore, William Carlos Williams did not have a great love of the popular poets of their day. Robert W. Service, who wrote The Cremation of Sam McGee, or Dorothy Parker, who wrote Men Seldom Make Passes at Girls Who Wear Glasses. Or Ogden Nash, who wrote Candy is Dandy But Liquor is Quicker. Or Edgar Guest, who wrote Somebody Said That It Couldn't Be Done, But He With a Smile Replied That Maybe It Couldn't, But He Would Be One Who Wouldn't Say So Till He Tried. What Billy Collins has done is to bring lightness, to bring humor, to bring humanity into the world of serious poets. He's been very successful, and he's written so many hit poems, which is so unusual. Poems that people want to hear over and over again, including his poem The Lanyard about summer camp and his poem Forgetfulness, which I used to know, but which begins, "The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of, as if one by one the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones." He is a distinguished professor at Lehman College of the City University of New York. He's a former poet laureate of the United States. It is traditional when welcoming a poet laureate of the United States for you please to look down at the floor. Do not look directly at him. And if I could have you all hum as you watch him. Billy Collins. So let's get right to the heart of the matter and not shilly-shally here, Mr. Collins.
You're not going to give me a bank loan, is that what you're telling me?
Your latest book of poetry is not collateral enough for us. We'll keep you in mind. Your success, your happy and lucky life, is due to the fact that you are an only child. You are an only child. You were your mother's pride and joy. You never had to compete with siblings for her love. You as an only child, you were ushered quickly into the adult world, into adult language. You learned social skills that to other people remain a mystery. You had your mother's love from the beginning. In the Oedipal struggle, you won hands down.
Do you want to sit over here, too?
Tell me about your mother.
Well, I had 6 brothers and sisters.
No.
Yeah, I was an only child and remain an only child. A friend of mine who's from a big Irish family in Chicago, we were talking about this fact of my life, and he looked at me and he said, "How many people have you lived in a house with? The most number of people, in your life?" And I said, 3, 2 other ones. I mean, he was amazed. I mean, he said, "So you never waited? There was no traffic in the house. You never had to wait. You never had to share." My parents had me when they were they were 39. I mean, they were almost 40. And this was 1941, and that was very late for that time, and even is a little late today. And neither of them had married before. My mother was a nurse. My father was an electrician, and both of them were just off. My mother traveling all over the country nursing, and my father's electrician work is a little more shadowy, but... And then they met and married and had me. So I don't think either of them at that age probably expected to have a child. So I was sort of, I was a godsend.
You were an only child and you were a miracle, a living miracle.
And when I say godsend, I mean baby Jesus.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
So I had a lot of attention. And my parents lived well into their 90s. So I had, I'd say, at least 50 years of quality parenting. And my mom was, she was from a very poor little farm about 90 miles or 100 miles north of Toronto in the Lake District up there, really Lake Simcoe, Lake Coochiching. And I was raised in Queens, that part of New York, kind of working class neighborhood, but still very urban. But every summer I would be able to go up to Canada and work. In other words, just get in the way on this my uncle's farm. So that was a great treat. But more specifically, my mother, as a schoolgirl, learned lots and lots of poetry. I mean, she went to school in the day when memorization was still a very respected, legitimate approach to poetry. And so, as I was growing up, I would hear poetry come out of her mouth. It would not be an act of literary, discourse or whatever. She would not stand up on a footstool and deliver poetry. But lines of Shakespeare, Browning, and others would be kind of braided in and out of her talk. And so I grew up thinking that poetry was not something that was just done in contained in volumes of leather-bound books, but it was part of someone's daily speech and their consciousness and their way of looking at the world.
You wrote a poem here in your new book, Visiting the Grave of your Parents. I think this is the second poem you've written about. One was about driving past the grave of your parents.
I could say that one for you, I think. I think. It's called No Time. In a rush this weekday morning, I tapped the horn as I speed past the cemetery where my parents lie buried side by side beneath a smooth slab of granite. Then all day long, I think of him rising up to give me that look of knowing disapproval while my mother tells him to lie back down. And if you think it's easy to write a poem about your dead parents that makes everyone laugh, just go home and try that. Yeah.
They're laughing at the familiarity of those last two lines.
Yeah.
We've all seen that disapproving look from our father.
Right. The critical father and the kind of reassuring mother.
Yes, right.
Would you let you shove this book over at me? Shall I read this poem as well?
No.
Okay. I didn't know. All right, then
have
it back.
Thanks. So you've pleased her writing poetry. You have fulfilled her her dream for you.
Uh-huh. She was not alive when I became poet laureate, but she was alive long enough to see me publish books and to, whenever I'd come over to her, the house, I mean, my books would be prominently displayed. I mean, on the not standing up, but, you know, on the coffee table. They would be out, at mm-hmm. any rate. So. Mm-hmm.
You were her poet laureate from yeah. the time you were a small child.
Oh, that's a nice way to put
her
it.
Her child laureate.
Her baby laureate. Mm. Never thought of it that way.
You were kind of a latecomer into the field of poetry. I know that you had some slight books, but you were in your 40s when that book came out from The Apple That Astonished Paris.
Right.
You went a long way down the road of academia. Mm. You went to Holy Cross. You went to University of California, Riverside. You got your PhD. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, why I didn't stop writing poetry is beyond me. I mean, I was, someone said that we're all born with something like 300 bad poems in us, and we have to just write them out to get rid of them. And the best time to do that is when you're in high school, if you can get them all out. But so I still had a lot in me, even in graduate school and beyond. Mm. Just to make a broader point about poetry, someone said that one of the paradoxes of the writing life is the only chance you have of being, I wouldn't even say original, but just fresh in voice, is through imitation. And I was spending all those years imitating other poets, and imitating them badly, because I think you start out by imitating people in such a direct way, it's almost like a travesty of their writing. And then if you're lucky, I think you begin to find more conducive influences. Mm. And then I think you begin combining these influences in such a way that people can't detect them. So that an original voice is really someone who has taken a lot of influences and kind of spun them all together so that their tails aren't showing, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm.
Did you ever want to be somebody else growing up in Queens, growing up in New York, a worldly sophisticate? Did you ever come from a small town in Minnesota? Or?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm sure if you had any kind of a boyhood, as I did, you wanted to be a deep sea diver, as I did. I'm not sure. That was certainly my dream, but no, I can't drag you into that. I wanted to be an architect when I was like in the eighth grade. My friend mm-hmm. Billy Koldrick and I were going to form a firm. Mm-hmm. I think we had read Ayn Rand a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we were going to have a firm called Collins and Koldrick, or Koldrick and Collins. And we couldn't agree, so that uh-huh. we decided not to become architects. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to stay in school. And I love being in school, and when you get a PhD, they tell you you can't go to school anymore. I mean, they say, no, I'm sorry, you can't sign up for any more classes. Mm-hmm. Here's your degree, and you have to go do something. Otherwise, I'd still be in school, I think. So, mm-hmm. But I did stay in school. I was just at the other end of the classroom. But. Mm-hmm. But I kind of stuck with it. I got lucky. You can't do it alone, and I had a number of editors who were very supportive. Miller Williams at the University of Arkansas Press took my first book when I was, as you reminded everyone, over 40. So my parents had me late, and I had my book late. Mm-hmm.
Just because you were engrossed in studies and being a graduate student?
Well, I wasn't very good at poetry. I really, I didn't get good, or as good as I am now, until I was in my mid-30s, did I figure out a way of writing that seemed more like me than anybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's a big insight for a poet, I think. Mm-hmm. I found my voice, you know, and the voice was a voice that could accommodate my personality. Mm-hmm. When I was reading, the people you mentioned, Hart Crane and Wallace Stevens and T.S. Eliot and et cetera, you know, I realized two things about poetry. First, it was very difficult to understand, mm-hmm. but you could understand was that the poet was miserable.
Yes.
And so I was so determined to be a poet, I decided I would write poems that were hard to understand in which I pretended to be miserable. Mm-hmm. As you said, I've had a lucky and charmed life, and I've been very happy all my life, more or less.
Yes.
But I pretended to be miserable, and I wrote poems that even I couldn't understand. And then I started reading people like Philip Larkin, like Kenneth Koch and Ron Padgett, and other writers who were able to be humorous without being silly. You know, they were able to be humorous, and particularly Philip Larkin, who was able to be humorous and dark. Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, something happened. I just point this out, that you're bringing the professor in me, as I can feel him coming out. But humor was very much alive in poetry. All. You know, Chaucer's very funny, Shakespeare wrote comedies, we have Augustan satire and metaphysical wit. Humor was just fine in poetry, and why shouldn't it be? Until we get to about 1800 with the English Romantics, and they struck a deal, a kind of backroom deal. And they got together and decided they would get rid of, from poetry, they would get rid of sex and humor and substitute landscape. And you'll have to agree, it's not a great deal. And it took a long time for humor to regain its place in poetry. Really, until I think about the I'd say about 150 years until people like Larkin in the 50s and the people you mentioned, Ogden Nash and others. And I love Ogden Nash. I wrote an essay on him once, and was surprised that nothing had been written on him really, except biographical stuff. You know, he was consigned to a kind of ghetto called light verse. Mm-hmm. And light verse is different. Someone pointed out that in light verse, it wants to start funny, stay funny, and end funny. You know, it's all the way through. Whereas more complex uses of humor use humor as a kind of a point of modulation, where a poem begins seriously and then maybe gets funny, or starts funny and drops into seriousness.
Let's not talk about humor, okay?
Okay.
Be funny.
That's all.
Don't talk about it.
Okay. It was the history of humor. That's not funny either.
The poem of yours that combines sex and humor that I love and that high school kids especially love is Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes, which is a beautiful, beautiful poem that. That is never silly. It's a poem about having sex with the bride of Amherst, and about taking off her white dress and then getting into those 19th century undergarments. And but you really do love her. She is standing motionless. Mm-hmm. She doesn't say anything.
She's looking out the window.
The window. In her bedroom there in Amherst, Massachusetts, and you.
I do say that whenever we spoke, there were dashes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were like a ship sailing toward the iceberg of her nakedness.
Very good.
Now that's not bad.
That's not bad.
Think about that for a moment. Take out a paper class and number from 1 to 5. And you said, there are some things I cannot tell you. Mm-hmm. So
Well, I drew the curtain.
You drew the curtain. Yeah. It's a gorgeous poem.
Thank you.
Do you still read it?
I don't read it much out loud, no. And since I don't read poems to myself of mine, I don't read it too much.
No.
I got some flack for it. There were a number of, of women who thought it was an offensive poem, and one or at least one, maybe two of them wrote poems called Taking Off Billy Collins's Clothes, which was described as a fairly unpleasant or disappointing experience. But I'll tell you, I mean, the motive for that really, I was not trying to be a wise guy, but I wrote that poem. And it's one of the first poems of mine, I think, or one of the only poems, rather, that began with the title. But it was around that time there was a spate biographical books of biographical criticism, all of them involving what I thought was a kind of People magazine level of snoopery about her private life, and particularly her sexual life. Was she celibate? Was she gay? Was she promiscuous? Etc. And I thought I would just put the matter to rest by having sex with her.
Well, since you brought up the question of prying into private life, let's talk about that for just a moment. Your poems are the opposite of confessional. One could read your poems and not know that you grew up Irish Catholic. One would not know anything about your loves. They wouldn't probably even know that you had been an English professor. What else would we know?
All the things that you're telling everybody. Right. Well, that I was Jesuit trained and that kind of thing. Well, I have a persona like most poets do. I mean, I have a speaking voice in the poems that's not obviously not identical to me. It's he is close to me, and I wish I were him because he has a very simple life. He doesn't work. He doesn't. He's never been to a laundromat. He's never taken out the garbage. He walks around walking the dog, looking out the window, falls into these speculations. So I don't present an autobiographical self. I mean, we all have one, which is a kind of conglomeration of all the things you're mentioning, class, race, married, single, where'd you grow up, where'd you go to school, religion. My persona really is sort of has just left, he doesn't have any of that stuff. Well, we know that much about him.
Oh, okay.
But someone asked me, because my persona drinks tea very often, and someone asked me, well, this was a careful reader, he said, what kind of tea do you like? And it struck me, I said, I drink coffee, my persona drinks tea, because he's a more refined person than I am. So I have not an autobiographical self. I have more of an immediate self. I have a spectator persona that just, he exists in the moment. With an autobiographical self, that poet would draw on experience, draw on autobiographical experience that happened, obviously, in the past. But my persona and that of, I think, some other poets creates an experience. I don't draw on a past experience. I'm trying to create an experience on the page that happens there and happens in the consciousness of the reader.
Your persona loves jazz. You like jazz?
No, I think it's for professors, for white professors. I do like jazz. We have lots of things in common.
Who am I talking to right now?
Well, that's your job to get that out of me.
Where did you come to have the name Billy? Your career as a poet might be different if you were William J. Collins, if you were W. J. Collins.
W. James Collins.
Yeah. Or W. James Collins. Even Jim Collins, I think, would be.
Well,
so you were Billy as a kid.
Yeah, I was Billy as a kid because my father was William, and he was the traditional name your kid after the dad. So he was Bill around the house, and I was Billy. But most people named Billy would shake that after about the ninth grade or something. Well, there's a literary reason, and when I started publishing, and when I started realizing I could get published, I sort of had to choose a name because I wasn't published before that. And I'll tell you a little secret, which is that when I was in college, I thought you had to have a literary name, like W.H. Auden or William Carlos Williams or T.S. Eliot. So I'll whisper this too, but when I published in the college literary magazine, I was W. James Collins.
No, really?
In fact, W.M., like for William,
yeah.
James Collins.
Oh.
And I envisioned myself in this kind of a library. But I, when I started getting published, I realized that was just sheer pretentiousness. But there is a poet. The real reason is that there is a poet named William Collins. He's a romantic or pre-romantic 18th century English poet. Mm-hmm. Wrote odes mostly and one firecracker poem called Ode to Evening. And I thought in my wishfulness that maybe someday I'll be in an anthology with William Collins. And now I am. So there are not two William Collinses. You know, I guess if my name was, you know, Robert Frost, I would change it to Bobby Frost.
It would have been a very different career for Mr. Robert Frost to have been Bobby Frost. But there must have been a time back in your college years when you were writing poems about misery that you did not actually feel, when you might have taken the name William James or James Collins, James
well,
W. Collins.
It didn't make any difference then because it wasn't being published. So, you know, it would be like writing out your name just to see it on a piece of paper.
Of course,
Yeah. But that stuck. And I guess it's also, I mean, that's the official reason that there would be two of us, two William Collinses. Mm-hmm. But I like the kind of anti-literary quality of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find it very, I'm still very self-conscious about being a poet. And I think I spend a lot of, a number of my poems are kind of shooting up these targets. Like I have a poem that makes fun of poetry workshops and readings and makes fun of this sort of image of the speculative poet. I'm potentially so pretentious that I have to hide that by making fun of all that.
I see. Okay. Where do your poems come from? I'm curious about this sonnet that you wrote, Golden Years, that starts out, "All I do these drawn-out days is sit in my kitchen at Pheasant Ridge, where there are no pheasants to be seen, and last time I looked, no ridge." You've never lived in suburbia, have you?
Well, I've lived in suburbia, but I've noticed I've never lived in one of those developments that really, it's a poem about the outcropping that happens pretty much all over the country of condominium developments and gated communities. And usually they carry these very rustic pastoral names involving an animal.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Beaver Hollow and Deer Run and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we all see these signs, and I think after driving past 500 of them, I noticed, it struck me that these are the animals that were expelled from this land in order to create these houses. So they've been banished from their habitat, and that the signs hanging there announcing the names of these condominium developments are really epitaphs for these poor creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the sonnet about a kind of widower who's sitting there in Pheasant Ridge. And then he goes over to Quail Falls to play bridge, but the absence of quail falls would only remind him of Pheasant Ridge, so he pretty much stays there. And then at the end of it he says, "Who frightened the fox and bulldozed the ledge? I ask in my kitchen at Pheasant Ridge."
Mm-hmm.
So it has a little seriousness at the end. I guess then that's a poem that's sort of funny because it's playing on these names. But at the end, "Who frightened the fox?" is supposed to be quite serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not nice to frighten a fox with a bulldozer.
It reminds me of your poem that begins, "I am the dog you put to sleep," as you refer to the needle of oblivion, and I am here to tell you this one simple thing: I never liked you,
right?
Not one bit. Were you a dog owner?
Yeah, I've always loved dogs. I had to get rid of my dog. Well, get rid of it. It's not a very nice way to put it. My dog had to be put down last year, and I'm sort of, but I have a dog-sized hole in my life that needs filling, and I will fill it one of these days. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, so I've written a lot of poems about dogs, about my dog, and I have a poem called The Dog on His Master, which is said by a dog. And the dog contemplates one of the painful facts of dog ownership, which is that dogs age faster than you do. I think I can say that. A dog on his master, as young as I look, I am growing older faster than he. 7-1 is the ratio, they tend to say. Whatever the number, I will pass him one day and take the lead the way I do on our walks in the woods. And if this ever manages to cross his mind, it would be the sweetest shadow I have ever cast on snow or grass. Mm-hmm. So.
Where does this gloom of poetry come from? I'm talking about just grassroots poetry. If you went to an open mic poetry reading where anyone who wanted to could come up and read a few poems, 90% of the poems, 95-96% of the poems would be elegies for dead loved ones, would be dead pets, would be poems, angry poems about bad fathers, about bad boyfriends, about... Where does this come from?
Well, I think there's a connection between a false one, but between sadness and intellectual seriousness. In other words, to be happy is to be thought to be stupid, and to be happy and funny is thought to be really stupid. These are deep connections if you're, the more anxiety you have, the more intelligence you have. It's like the connection that used to be between intelligence and smoking. You know, there's someone once said when he was trying to quit that he saw a bunch of people at a party smoking, and he said, it looked like they had something to smoke about, you know. It was a sort of puffing was a sign of mental activity. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think basically the content of a lot of literature is misery or is a complex unhappiness. And in teaching literature, as I have for many years, there's often, especially an introductory course, a question that comes up every semester after about 6 weeks. The hand goes up and the question is, why are these works so depressing? Are we going to read anything fun this semester? And the answer is no, you're not. Because the content of literature tends to be misery. But I'm quick to add that the form of literature, you know, the shape of the sonnet or the discrete acts and scenes of a Shakespeare play, you know, and the thematic structure, the signs of intelligent application, and they provide happiness. You know, they give us happiness. So the content is misery, but the form is pleasure, and that's sort of the tension of literature, and that's what's wrong with television. Mm-hmm. Not that you asked that, but you have happy content, happy form, so there's no tension. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. John Updike described your poems as limpid, as consistently surprising, and more serious than they may appear. What is limpid? I don't know what.
That's like the Feast of the Epiphany with it. What's myrrh? Limpid. Well, it doesn't mean really limp.
No.
Or slightly limp. Uh-huh. Limpid means clear. It means transparent, and maybe even like untroubled, serene, clear.
Clear.
Yeah.
Why didn't he just say clear?
Well, because he's John Updike. Uh-huh. Yeah. John Updike can't just say clear.
Okay. You put in several decades as a teacher, mm-hmm. teaching literature to the
and composition.
and composition to the reluctant. And almost everyone I know who taught college English wound up exhausted, burnt out, bitter, tired of reading more term papers about Huck Finn. How do you look back on
That's me.
Your teaching career?
How did you know? I always enjoyed teaching. I think I enjoyed it up until about 4 years before I kind of trailed off and stopped teaching. I love going into it. I mean, I love being in a classroom. When you wake up in the morning, you know that there are, you know, maybe three groups of 20 people that are sitting there waiting for you to say something, and you have someone to talk to. It takes the loneliness out of writing, as someone said. But I think it's what happens is reading as student writing is spiritually bad for you. I mean, reading bad writing is just not good. It's not good for your writing, and it's not good for your soul. It just has a deeply damaging effects over the years. And all that time, the dutiful time spent writing these marginal corrections, like, you know, comma splice or awkward, and realizing, you know, they say the average American spends like 4 months waiting at stop signs or something. And I think I've used a year of my life making these little notations, and then you realize nobody reads them. And no one says, oh, awkward, well, let me make that more graceful. Let me go home and do that. So there's this sort of futility about it, and the reluctance that you mention on the part of students, I think, becomes clearer as one gets more tired and less hopeful. So it has its, as someone said of the music of Wagner, it has its moments, but it also has its hours.
Futility is a part of a writer's life. However, we there's no cost benefit analysis. I think it was John Barrowman who was asked once, "How do you know if your poems are good?" And he said, "You don't. And if you need to know, you're in the wrong line of work." So anybody who writes has to face the possibility that you're wasting your life.
You'll never know. It's a very powerful poem of his. You'll never know. Well, you know, I mean, if you're lucky, you know that you give some pleasure while you're alive. And I think one of the motives for writing, or one of the reliable things, is that it will extend your voice beyond the grave to some point. I mean,
you think so?
Well, at least for a month or two. I mean, maybe I won't be, you know.
The name of the poet is the first to go. Followed obediently by the title, the fact that he was a poet laureate.
Well, you know, a French critic talks, he came up with this idea of le temps entre les deux morts, the time between your two deaths. So, French. We all thought we just died once. Well, the bad news is you're going to die twice. So you have a physical death, but then the second death is the point in history when your name is completely forgotten from the face of the earth. So it could be, you know, you can imagine your great-great-great-great-grandchild is telling a story about you like 150 years from now. And then the people who hear that story forget it, and then there's nothing left of you. Writing is a way of lengthening that time between your two deaths.
But you go down into the deep stacks of any library in America, and there they all are, people who once were considered, considerable poets, John Peel Bishop and Richard Eberhardt and Caroline Gordon, and these people were all, high in the ranks, and now nothing.
Well, I think everybody fades, but it's a way of extending yourself gone. A little bit.
Gone.
Yeah, gone. Yeah.
Nobody.
Not fading. Yeah.
Nobody reads them at all.
Right.
Nobody.
So you remember them. You just said their names. So.
Yeah. I was in graduate school once too. So when you consider that, you consider all of the good people who've gone off to oblivion, and then you consider all of the trash that people love so dearly. Poetry slams, hip hop, music, all of the really lousy things that people hug to their bosoms. Doesn't it make you believe in a God? So that there can be some justice somewhere, somewhere.
Well, there's a lot, I wouldn't go that far, but there's a lot of activity that goes on under the heading of poetry. The word poetry covers such a broad territory. It's stretched to the point of meaninglessness. A little like the word sports, you know, because under sports you would have, you know, the National Basketball Association and curling and luge. I mean, all these activities that are very separate. I wish they'd come up with other more discreet names instead of coming under the umbrella of poetry.
Well, you're in under a big tent. Read another poem from this wonderful new book, Horoscopes for the Dead. Okay. You have another poem in which you visit your parents' grave.
Right. Should we go back there?
You could. And you also have a poem here which is one I don't understand at all. And
I know what it's called. It's called Lakeside.
No, it's called Palermo.
Oh, Palermo. Okay, good. Let me read that one. I've never written what's called a Fulbright poem because I've never had a Fulbright. But when you get a Fulbright, you have to write a Fulbright poem. And a Fulbright poem is a poem that takes place in Europe and has a fountain in it.
Yeah.
And so when you come back from your Fulbright, you hand in your poem, and they go, okay, there's the fountain, very good, and you're checked off. But this does take place in Europe, in Sicily, in August. The poem is really about heat and its effects on my perception. Palermo. It was foolish of us to leave our room. The empty plaza was shimmering. The clock looked ready to melt. The heat was a mallet, striking a ball and sending it bouncing into the nettles of summer. Even the bees had knocked off for the day. The only thing moving besides us, and we had since stopped under an awning, was a squirrel who was darting this way and that, as if he were having second thoughts about crossing the street, his head and tail twitching with indecision. You were looking in a shop window, but I was watching the squirrel, who now rose up on his hind legs and, after pausing to look in all directions, began to sing in a beautiful voice a melancholy aria about life and death, his forepaws clutched against his chest, his face full of longing and hope as the sun beat down on the roofs and awnings of the city and the earth continued to turn and hold in position the moon, which would appear later that night as we sat in a cafe, and I stood up on the table with the encouragement of the owner and sang for you and the others the song the squirrel had taught me how to sing.
That's one of the longest sentences ever in American poetry. I guess my confusion is that I wish that you would tell me who we is or are.
Oh,
what's your name?
We was my wife then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the we.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What's the big mystery?
Well, it's because I'm not autobiographical.
Okay.
I'm just there with the squirrel.
All right.
She's not important in this poem.
Yeah. Ooh. Grave.
Grave?
Yes.
Shall I read it?
Yes, please.
Okay.
You wrote it. Why not read it?
Yeah. Grave. What do you think of my new glasses? I asked as I stood under a shade tree before the joined grave of my parents. And what followed was a long silence that descended on the rows of the dead and on the fields and the woods beyond, one of the 100 kinds of silence, according to the Chinese belief, each one distinct from the others, but the differences being so faint that only a few special monks were able to tell them all apart. They make you look very scholarly, I heard my mother say, once I lay down on the ground and pressed an ear into the soft grass. Then I rolled over and pressed my other ear to the ground, the ear my father likes to speak into, but he would say nothing, and I could not find a silence among the 100 Chinese silences that would fit the one that he created, even though I was the one who had just made up the business of the 100 Chinese silences, the silence of the night boat and the silence of the lotus, cousin to the silence of the temple bell, only deeper and softer, like petals at its farthest edges.
Poets have become famous in America. The poets who have become famous in some part because of bad behavior. The older generation, the alcoholic generation. Dylan Thomas, from the 40s into the 50s until he drank himself to death, was famous for drinking everyone else under the table, going off and doing a very professional poetry reading and then chasing women at receptions afterward and trying to make off with faculty wives.
Oh boy.
John Barrowman was famous for his alcoholism. Other poets, Charles Bukowski was famous for drinking as he read poetry and then throwing the beer bottles into the audience, which threw them back. Was any of this ever of interest to you? the possibilities of bad
water.
Behavior?
Yeah.
Possibility of making a spectacle of yourself?
No, I'm not driven like that. I don't find any compulsions. I'm not.
Because your parents lived to be
90. Because my parents lived to be 90. No, I don't have my head down on the desk here. Maybe it's that. Maybe I had good parenting. I don't know, but I don't feel any compunction to be excessive. Quite frankly, I think Stephen Dedalus talks about the quiet habits of obedience that were instilled in him by his Jesuit training. I think the combination of my mother, who was a real moral compass, and a woman of great deportment. I spent about a third of my childhood writing thank you notes with her looking over my shoulder at a desk that looked like this. And a rather rigorous sort of 16 years of the full metal jacket of Catholic education instilled in me habits that include punctuality and respect for others and certain courtesies.
Mm-hmm. But still, you must have imbibed this idea that genius and madness are connected, and self-destructiveness is a sure sign of talent. To throw yourself down that rocky slope and onto the rocks is a poet's duty.
Well, I think that's that's an inflated stereotype, because we don't hear about T.S. Eliot the banker, William Carlos Williams the pediatrician, Wallace Stevens the insurance executive, who sat at a desk like this. So we don't hear about them drinking themselves to death, and their stories don't get glamorized the way Dylan Thomas's would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nonetheless, it's a powerful stereotype.
It is indeed.
Your poetry is lighter, I would say, because you do not, so far as we know, have any children. And so you've never actually suffered in the way that in the way that most people have suffered.
Well, I have a. I'd love to read another poem for you that's about that.
Are you changing the subject?
Or? No, I'm right on topic here. I have a potential stepdaughter of the future, and I've written a poem about her. If you wouldn't mind me reading that, and it's called "To My Favorite 17-Year-Old American High School Girl." Do you realize that if you had started building the Parthenon on the day you were born, that you would be all done in only 2 more years? Of course, you would have needed lots of help. So never mind. You're fine just as you are. You are loved for simply being yourself. But did you know that at your age, Judy Garland was pulling down $150,000 a picture? Joan of Arc was leading the French army to victory. And Blaise Pascal had cleaned up his room. No, wait, I mean he had invented the calculator. Of course, there will be time for all that later in your life, after you come out of your room and begin to blossom, or at least pick up all your socks. For some reason, I keep remembering that Lady Jane Grey was Queen of England when she was only 15. But then again, she was beheaded, so never mind her as a role model. A few centuries later, when he was your age, Franz Schubert was doing the dishes for his family. But that did not keep him from composing 2 symphonies, 4 operas, and 2 complete masses as a youngster. But of course, that was in Austria, at the height of Romantic lyricism, not here in the suburbs of Cleveland. Frankly, who cares if Annie Oakley was a crack shot at 15, or if Maria Callas debuted as Tosk at 17? We think you are special by just being you, playing with your food and staring into space. By the way, I lied about Schubert doing the dishes, but that doesn't mean he never helped out around the house.
So this looks like a recent poem.
Yeah.
So you're still at work and...
Yeah.
And doing things?
Yeah, working away.
That's good. What did you do today?
Slaving away. I sat in the back of a car that drove me from Columbus, Ohio, down here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a productive day.
No? Nothing came to you?
Nothing much, no. But sometimes there'll be an observation that later delivers itself as the beginning of a poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all like points of insertion. I mean, they're just a few things to write about in poetry, but I think one is always looking for some little starting place, some little phrase or trigger that starts the wheels turning. And mm-hmm. But it can be in anywhere, just about.
Anything here in the room here that?
Well, this still life of the pitcher and the glasses mm-hmm. is quite limpid. See, I used it in a sentence.
Just two glasses and a pitcher?
Yeah, I think...
Where do you go with this?
I like to start with very little. I mean, very often people will say, oh, you're going to write a poem about that. Mm-hmm. And they're always wrong. For example, I was on an airplane a few days ago, and the pilot, we were at the gate, and the pilot said, everyone has to get off the plane because there's a snake on the plane. Well, then we got back on the plane because it turned out it was a rubber snake. And almost everyone I've told the story to says, oh, you write a poem about that. No, it's just there's too much going on. I mean, this is the water glasses. There's nothing going on there, and then you can make something happen.
Mm.
But the snake is just it's too much content. Mm-hmm. I don't like a lot of content.
I am the snake who was on the plane that you were taking to Cleveland. A rubber snake, but you didn't know that yet.
Come back to tell you.
So where do these lead you?
Well, it reminds me of absence, and I think a lot of my poems are about things that aren't there. I mean, I'm kind of editing you out of this of the scene. Because you're also too much content, you know. Which is a compliment, of course. It's a compliment, of course.
Oh. Oh. All right. All right. So you've come from good genes, two parents who lived on into their 90s. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole stretch of time, a whole
few more
career,
years left, yeah.
A whole career ahead of uh-huh. you.
Well, we'll see.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm pretty content to write more poems. I really have found I'm not interested in developing, really. I mean, I think every poem is a step forward or a reminder that I'm still a poet. You know, poets go back to zero a lot more frequently than writers of prose, say novelists would be the best example. Mm-hmm. Because we're able to finish a poem, often in a few hours, or a couple of days, maybe. And then we go back to zero. We have to press restart. And whereas if you're working on a novel, you're working on it for 2 or 3 years, and you work on it every day, and you push it forward and all that. You know that. And you write poetry, too, so you know the other. But you have the prose to go back to. But if you're just a poet, you're facing the blank page a lot more frequently than other writers. So it's a life of anxiety.
Well, boo-hoo. Gosh, our hearts go out to you. When are you going to write the play? I mean, once you've picked up this persona and you learn to write these beautiful monologues of yours, the natural, logical, reasonable next step is to write the play.
I wouldn't know where to start.
Oh, come now.
Yeah. I think it would be like picking up an oboe and not knowing how to play.
No, it's the same language you're using in these poems.
Do you think I should start with a one-act play?
No, I think you should write a full three-act play that opens on Broadway and is a huge success.
Wow. Never thought about that.
How many are in favor of Billy writing a play?
That's quite a bit of encouragement.
There's some encouragement. Some encouragement. They're doubtful, but now it's your chance to do that, to break through. We would be so proud.
I'll try.
Will you?
I'll give it a shot.
Will you try?
Right.
I hope that you will. I wish you all the best. I wish you all the best, as does everyone else I know and everyone here. We think the world of you, and thank you so much for these poems.
I want to thank you.
I think that was really good.